The third case for oral argument this morning is Danny Wise, claimant but appellee versus Brooks Construction Services and Equity Mutual Insurance. It's listed as appellants, but my understanding is that Mr. Widener, you are the appellant in this case, correct?
Correct.
All right. And then Mr. Schultz, you're representing all the appellees or the insurance company? All right, very well. I guess then, Mr. Widenauer, you have 20 minutes, sir.
Justices of the Supreme Court, counsel, may it please the court. I'd like to begin this morning by discussing the injuries that Mr. Wise received, which leads us here today. The first injury occurred on July 5, 2001, while Mr. Wise was working in Alexandria, Minnesota. He was struck by a 55-gallon drum, rendered unconscious. He was taken to the hospital, subsequently received treatment from several physicians. Because of that injury, the insurance company accepted compensability and paid benefits to Mr. Wise. Ultimately, Mr. Wise was released from Dr. Asfora's care on January 14 of 2003, and he was paid permanent partial disability. While he was treating for the neck injury he had sustained as a result of July 5, 2001, he sustained an injury on December 5, 2001. Now, the mechanism of injury for this December injury, the mechanism of injury was he was walking down a muddy ramp from a tool shed, and he slipped on the ramp and hyperextended his back. Mr. Wise subsequently reported the injury in a timely fashion and sought treatment from Dr. Hoverston in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. Dr. Hoverston is an orthopedic physician with whom Mr. Wise had a previous doctor-patient relationship. With respect to the argument of compensability, I think Dr. Hoverston's testimony is pivotal. It goes to the question as to whether or not the December 5, 2001 injury was a contributing factor regarding Mr. Wise's need for medical treatment and ultimately surgery. Now, touching on Mr. Wise's previous treatment with Dr. Hoverston, Dr. Hoverston first started treating Mr. Wise in April of 1988 when Mr. Wise received a back injury at work, same employer, Brooks Construction. In 1992, he had surgery for that injury. Then again in 1995, October of 1995, he had a lower back injury, which required surgery again. And then in May of 1999, he had another lower back injury. All of these injuries occurred while working for the employer, Brooks Construction. Mr. Wise returned to Dr. Hoverston approximately 1 week after the injury happened. Dr. Hoverston initially had treated him conservatively, but then ordered an MRI, which revealed a bulging disc at the L3-L4 level to the right. That resulted in a decompressive laminectomy on September 22 of 2002. Subsequently, Mr. Wise was released from Dr. Hoverston's care in October of 2003. During that period of time, Mr. Wise was ordered off of work by Dr. Hoverston for 21 weeks and incurred approximately $20,000 in medical expenses. Dr. Hoverston's testimony was by way of deposition that was submitted to the Department of Labor. Initially, Dr. Hoverston testified that this injury was not, the injury was not a contributing factor for Mr. Wise's treatment. That was in letter form on January 22 of 2002, which apparently the insurer had sent Dr. Hoverston a letter, and he responded by writing back on the letter and sending it back. Based upon that opinion that it was degenerative rather than anything else, the insurer denied benefits. Dr. Hoverston's deposition also indicates that before this December 5 injury, from the period from August 10, 1999 to December 5, 2001, Mr. Wise did not have any lower back symptoms, any radicular symptoms into his legs. The injury which occurred in July of 2001 was, again, to the head, which caused a bulging disc in his neck, which again, he had to have surgery for. So prior to December 5, 2001, Dr. Hoversten did not consider Mr. Wise to be a surgical candidate. However, Dr. Hoversten changes his opinion after surgery. Apparently, Dr. Hoversten found a facet fracture, which had been previously unaccounted for. In his deposition, he didn't think that the bulging disc was necessarily degenerative in nature, given the previous existing condition. He then attributed the condition, Mr. Wise's condition, to the December 5, 2001 injury. It has been argued that Dr. Hoversten's testimony should not be dispositive in this matter. However, Dr. Hoversten's opinions are very well founded. They establish a causal relationship between the injury and the need for treatment. In the conclusion of law that the department wrote, I believe it's number 11, Mr. Wise established by a preponderance of the evidence that the July 5 injury is and remains a major contributing cause of his disability, impairment, or need for treatment. This was upheld by the circuit court, and I would urge that this court affirm.
Where exactly in the deposition does Hoversten say that?
That was in the brief and in the appendix. It's finding of fact 46, finding of fact 77, and finding of fact 78.
But what page on the deposition?
Because
I understood this to be the dispute in the case. Essentially, Hoversten didn't use the magic words. I don't like using that phrase, but that's kind of what it's come down to. And I'd like to see in the deposition where he used the major contributing cause phrase with respect to the July work injury.
When I ask, I don't have that right in front of me, Justice, but...
Well, you can supplement it later then.
I do have the quotes in the appendix. When asked whether or not the work-related injury was a mechanism of the aggravation, Dr. Hoversten said yes. And then when he became symptomatic, I asked him then when did he become symptomatic? All right, did he become symptomatic after the fall in the mud? And he said yes. Clearly, the fall in the mud was the aggravation that led to more radiculopathy and the need to do more surgery. So the magic language. That's as close as we come in his deposition, I believe. Ultimately, the department did fine, and we would urge that the department be reaffirmed. The appellees in this matter argue that the medical fee schedule should apply after this finding. I argue that the 62-4-1.3 presupposes a situation where the employer and the insurer have accepted compensability. Further, there was no showing at hearing what the medical fee schedule was. Clearly, this would be inconsistent. After they denied, the insurer and the employer denied benefits to Mr. Wise, they want to take advantage of the very same benefits under the code that they have denied. I'd like to turn to our argument regarding odd lot disability, permanent total disability benefits pursuant to SDCL 62-4-53. That statute requires that we consider the physical condition, age, training, and experience, plus the type of work available in the claimant's community in order to determine whether or not he can obtain anything more than sporadic employment resulting in insubstantial income. As the facts showed at the hearing, his physical condition, this gentleman has had three previous back surgeries and one neck surgery. His lifting restrictions are 20 to 25 pounds. which limits him to light to medium duty work. Danny, or Mr. Wise, was also born on November 9, 1955. He's now 50 years old. He was 48 at the time of the hearing. His training, testimony revealed that his training consisted of high school. He graduated from high school, I believe, from Washington High School in Sioux Falls in 1974. He doesn't have any computer skills, and his post-high school training is very limited, and that's just to that which he participated in with respect to the Volunteers of America. They assisted him with some acquiring some job skills to re-enter the job market. His experience up to the time of the injury on December 5 of 2001 was entirely in heavy manual labor. For 28 or 27 years, he was a concrete construction foreman for Brooks Construction, the employer here. That's his customary line of employment, is concrete. Now, the type of work available, and if we shift and look at the type of work available in the employee's community, we have to look at what his physical restrictions are first. Can he get, or are there jobs available in the community within his restrictions? Expert testimony revealed that there are entry-level jobs, light-duty jobs, at $6 to $8 per hour, which was far below his agreed-upon workers' compensation rate of $468. So, ultimately, Mr. Wise was unable, pursuant to the definition of the statutes, unable to obtain anything more than sporadic employment resulting in insubstantial income, as defined by 62-4-52, subsection 2.
Well, Caro testified to the contrary.
Yes, he did.
And why shouldn't we accept or defer to the fact finder's choice of experts on this?
In terms of the...
Which vocational expert to believe? We had conflicting vocational experts here.
I think further on in the statute, it requires that the plaintiff present expert testimony regarding the feasibility, the burden then shifts, the burden then shifts to the employer to present that evidence. We presented evidence with respect to the whether there were jobs out there, and his career in the form of his job search. Mr. Wise looked for work in the Argus Leader Classified. He went to the Career Center and looked there for jobs. He also participated in Volunteers of America. He did a very substantial job search, which led him only to get the job at Austed's for $7 an hour. Upon examination of Mr. Caro, some of the jobs that he identified were non-existent. The employer that he identified did not have a concrete laborer foreman position. Further, his testimony, both at deposition and at hearing, indicated that Mr. Caro couldn't identify a position readily available in the Sioux Falls marketplace, which would be at or above that disability benefit rate. Turning to the reasonable good faith job search, I just mentioned the manner in which Mr. Wise had gone out and looked for a job. He did find jobs within his customary line of employment. He was at two construction companies, both of which didn't have light to medium duty work. He had to separate himself from those jobs because they were outside of his physical restrictions. And that's in finding of fact 86 that Mr. Wise did perform a good faith job search. Now, the statute requires that he does a good faith job search unless it's medically or vocationally, or unless there's a medical or vocational finding that shows such efforts would be futile. I believe we at hearing showed both. Not only did Mr. Wise put forth a reasonably good a good faith job search, but also we had a vocational testimony that the same would be futile. Mr. Audette opined that Mr. Wise was limited to light duty jobs at $6 to $8. Those are at findings of fact 83, 84, and 85.
Now, were those experts, they testified live?
Yes. Ultimately, that led to conclusion of Law 18, in which the department held a good faith work search would be futile. The burden then shifts to the employer at this point to show that it's that suitable work is continuously available in the community. I've covered a portion of that in response to Justice Zinter's case or his question. But I think the important point here that I wrote in the brief also that I'd like to stress is that conclusion 19, the department states Mr. Wise is unable to obtain anything more than sporadic employment resulting in insubstantial income. Three conclusions later in number 22, the department writes, the employer demonstrated that there were positions open and available within Mr. Wise's community that would pay him a suitable wage. I think those two conclusions of law conflict with each other. The test for both, I would submit, is whether or not Mr. Wise can re-enter the job market at or above his workers' compensation benefit rate. I think the better view here would be to review the cross-examination testimony of Mr. Caro together with the evidence that's put forth in Mr. Wise's testimony regarding his work search. I think that would lead us to the conclusion that the conclusion of law number 22 must be erroneous and therefore reversed. I alluded to this also in response to a question regarding the statute's mandate that the claimant put forth medical or expert opinion regarding the feasibility of a vocational rehabilitation. That's a mandate that's in that statute by the legislature. I think the department must be reversed in their findings regarding the feasibility of a vocational rehabilitation for two reasons. First, I don't believe it's realistic. It doesn't appear to be realistic. In looking at Mr. Wise's life circumstances, and I've gone over these, but he's 48 years old at the hearing. He's had really no formal education since 1974, no computer skills. His customary line of employment was that of concrete. Clearly, it's reasonable to assume that as an employee such as Mr. Wise gets older, the likelihood of success of a vocational rehabilitation program would diminish. Similarly, we have to analyze what it would take to re-enter the job market at or near that previous wage. He's a high wage earner. He was earning $18.50 per hour, I believe. For an unskilled worker in Sioux Falls, that's a high wage earner. Now, the employer and the insurer presented evidence from Mr. Caro, and Mr. Caro testified that Mr. Wise could go back to school and become a cardiac ultrasound technician, go into computer servicing, laser electro-optics, or nuclear medicine, or vascular ultrasound, or biomedical equipment technician. All of these programs are very, very technical, and they are vastly different than what his customary line of employment was. Further, Mr. Wise would require remedial assistance before he even entered one of these programs. Also, there was testimony that there's a waiting list for these testimonies. But I think when we're looking at the reasonableness and realisticness of going forward with the feasibility of a vocational program, we have to look at it in terms of is it reasonable that he would even get into the programs? Is it reasonable that he would complete the program in a timely fashion to re-enter the job market? And is it reasonable to assume that he would leave the vocational program and find a job? Now, mind you, we're talking about a 50-year-old gentleman who's going to school with people in their early 20s, going into the same job market and competing with those people in the same job market after having been a concrete worker for 27 years. There's just no guarantees.
What efforts did he make for Reed to question or inquire as for Volk rehab or retraining?
He made none other than the Volunteers of America. The Volunteers of America.
What was that again? Remind me what he did there.
His counselor at the Career Center referred him to the Volunteers of America, which teaches individuals certain rudimentary job skills, how to run a cash register, how to read receipts, how to stock shelves.
So those wouldn't have been really job retraining skills, or would they?
Yeah, I would say they would, because they're light duty. The occupations which those would require would be light duty. So yes, I would say it would be.
Your time has expired. Thank you, Mr. Wiedner.
Justices, thank you.
Mr. Schultz, you have 20 minutes.
Please the court. Counsel, I'd like to kind of pick up where Mr. Wiedner left off, if I may. As I see this situation working out, the Department of Labor made a couple of rulings on the permanent total disability claim that were of significance in the ultimate analysis of this case. The first ruling was that Mr. Wise had performed a reasonable good faith work search. Now, how did she arrive at that conclusion? Well, she listened to Mr. Audette, who said there really aren't any jobs out there. They're going to pay more than $6 to $8, and that was basically how she got there. Parsing a little deeper, digging a little deeper there, though, there's more to it than that. Mr. Audette admitted that he did not know what job search Mr. Wise did, and that admission comes up in the transcript at page 110 and following. In addition, the claimant himself said, I made a couple of applications. A couple of applications. That's his job search here. He says later, 8 to 12 applications. Okay, give him 12. That's his job search here. That's not sufficient. That's not a reasonable good faith job search effort. And now, even at the time of the hearing, he was working part-time, 25 hours a week. Well, why is he working part-time? He's authorized by the FCA, by the Functional Capacities Evaluation, to go to work 8 hours a day. Maybe there's something to that. I don't know. But it strikes me that he's not working up to his full capacity at that point in time. And in fact, Mr. Carroll, our vocational expert, said that he felt this man was underemployed by choice. Now, that's really important here, because the language good faith job search effort is in the statute. Now, where does that really come from? Well, this court has a long history before the statute was enacted of talking about motivation. Motivation to return to work. That motivation, those motivation cases are like Tensvold and Kennedy, and somewhere along the line I got my list here, but I don't remember them all. I'd be happy to cite them if the court would so desire. But the point is that part of the problem in this case is that the department concluded he had made this good faith work search effort, and we didn't think he did. We thought the guy had found this job, this part-time job, and that was good enough for him. And in fact, he says so. He says he's more concerned with his back than going out and finding a higher-paying job. What more do you need? This man was not conducting a good faith job search effort, or conversely, was not motivated to find work for whatever reason. We think that's where a mistake was made. Ultimately, the Department of Labor ruled in our favor, but we maintained that position throughout the appeal of this case. And in that point, you know, I do agree in one respect a little bit with some of the some of the comments from Mr. Wiedenauer. There is some funny language in the findings offered by the department that were ultimately signed. And I just direct the court to these two findings and kind of suggest that maybe these kind of don't play out together too well. 85 and 86 of the findings entered by the Department of Labor on June 23, 2005, read as follows. Audit credibly opined the claimant will not be able to find work that will pay him at his workers' compensation rate, and the 86 says claimant performed a reasonable job search. Now, compare that to 91 and 92. 91 says Carroll provided these job leads to claimant, but claimant did not apply for any of these positions. 92 says claimant did not contact any of the prospective employers because he already had a job. Claimant also was not interested in the positions because he was more concerned with his back than going out and finding a higher paying job. We think that there's a fundamental collision in those findings, and we think, obviously contrary to claimant's position, we think that the real finding that this suggests is that he did not make a reasonable good faith job search effort, and that would end the question. You wouldn't go beyond that. You'd say, no prima facie case, guy's not obviously unemployable, did not make reasonable good faith job search effort, end of case. Thinking about what's been proven before in this court as a reasonable good faith job search effort, if you think about those cases that are out there where people have tried to demonstrate that, the numbers are not 12, they're 70, they're 200. Those are the kind of job search when you really can feel confident about saying to the Department of Labor, here, we did this. This case doesn't have that. This case does not have that. And I submit that the Department of Labor was wrong when they made that ruling and found that he had conducted this good faith job search effort.
So why would we even address it, though, if we rule in your favor?
Well, I guess we
would be upholding the ultimate decision.
I agree, and I point this out because it bothered me when I was going through the case, and I thought to myself, why do we even get over here to this, you know, the burden shifting proof and blah blah blah, whatever that language is. I don't profess to have it all in my head right now, but I just thought that would be a shorter answer. When the Department of Labor got around to this and said, okay, he's made his prima facie case, he conducted an appropriate job search. Okay, now what do you have to do, claimant, to demonstrate entitlement to benefits? What the department said was, hey, you know, you have not demonstrated that you can't benefit from retraining. You have not demonstrated that you cannot get this accomplished. And one of the problems the claimant had with regard to retraining issue is that he suggested, well, I'm just not a school guy, and furthermore, I don't qualify for financial assistance due to my household income. Those were his reasons. His department didn't look very happily on that particular point of view. They felt, look, you know, you're telling these guys that you want benefits for life. You want to be paid weekly $468 a week the rest of your life with cost of living increases. And you're telling me that the reason you're not doing anything else is because you're not a school guy? And because you don't qualify for financial assistance due to your household income, that's your excuse. The department didn't, I think, take that very kindly and said, no, that's not good enough. You can't do that. So
what did your experts, I mean, is it realistic to think that he could have been retrained on some of those jobs that your expert testified
to? You know,
I know what those jobs are. They're fairly technical.
I understand, Your Honor, and I guess my point of view on this is that He'll never know unless he does an aptitude test. He'll never know until he gets an interest inventory done. And nobody will ever know because this guy just shut it off. And that's the problem. When you see these things done in a more reasonable and credible fashion, they've done those things. And they've explored those opportunities, and they have reasonably concluded that they're not appropriate. This man just said, nope, not doing it. And I think that's part of the reason the department reached their ultimate conclusion. Personally, I don't know what he is capable of. I know that his aptitude test from ancient times suggested that he was in the middle third of math, top third of math, middle third in general knowledge. That suggests some capability. It doesn't mean you put him on the scrap heap of society and pay benefits the rest of his life. It means you at least ought to give it a try. So that's what I won't profess to know how he would have worked out or whether these jobs or these programs would have worked for him. But when a guy doesn't try, that does kind of thwart the whole system. And, you know, this is really a policy decision, right? The Supreme Court is interpreting a legislative act that makes a policy statement saying, you know, before you're going to get benefits for life, you've got to try some other things. You've got to try to find work. You've got to try to be retrained. You've got to try to do some of these things. And here we think neither one of those things was accomplished. We think that we ended discussion after the job search issue, but obviously the department went on, so we're willing to talk about that. I should point out that one of the things that was interesting in the case in the transcript was that Mr. Audette agreed that retraining would benefit this man. And the department latched onto that as well, saying, conclusions of law 25 through 27 say that claimant would benefit from retraining in various ways. But the point of this is that if his own guy says he'd benefit from retraining, could get a higher wage if he were retrained, that's got to be pretty conclusive on that issue. Let me turn my attention, if I may, then to the other interesting issue. Actually, there's two of them there.
Before you get to that, the positions that were supposedly available in the economy at that time that were suggested to him, were they light-duty jobs or were they heavy-duty jobs?
Every one of the ones that Mr. Carroll identified were all light-duty supervisory jobs. Now, you get into that kind of war where the practical and the theoretical kind of cross paths, and nobody really knows how somebody stays necessarily all the way through a supervisory job and does not do something beyond light duty. I mean, there are people that do that. There are people that don't, at least in my experience. But the jobs that Mr. Carroll identified were all supervisory, which would mean they're not going to be the laboring, pushing the trowel around, things like that. So we felt we're pretty good about that, honestly, Justice. We felt like that was a viable alternative to what this guy had done or hadn't done.
And it's your position he rejected them all because they were not light duty?
You know, I guess the rejection that he threw back at us was basically he was this line from Finding of Fact 92, where he was more concerned about his back than going out and finding a higher paying job. That's all I can think of. I suspect that's the only answer we're going to get. He just felt like he was not going to go out and try those. He had a job, part-time, working at Austed's, and I guess that he felt that was good enough for them. And again, that's further evidence, I think, that he's employable. I mean, the fellow had a job and was working, and so it helps our case that he was employed.
According to the testimony, how many years would he have had to go to school in order to accomplish one of these jobs, like cardiovascular ultrasound?
There was no doubt he's going to need remediation in math. We were quite confident of that in order to make it through any one of these more technical courses. So the normal course period, which was, I think, 2 years, would have had to have been extended by a year or so or maybe less. I'm not sure about for the specifics of that remedial period. But the coursework itself was always a two-year program, if I remember right.
And then the likelihood of jobs being available upon completion of that 3 years down the road when he's 54?
Yep. Well, of course, now 54. If he'd done it back then, it would have been different. But the Southeast has had like a very high 90%, 100% rate of placement. They were really, really high. The testimony was very clear about that. Their most recent information was very high placement rate. It wasn't, you know, in the 50% range. It was the 195% range. So, again, we felt good about that part of the picture. The fact that he didn't even offer to go through it or examine it was kind of, the problem for him. If I may go on to the next item, the lumbar spine issue. Justice Sinner hit it on the head, I think. Although it's been said in the briefing by claimant that Dr. Hoverston clearly stated an opinion causally relating the surgery he did at L3-4 to the injury in December of 2001 with a requisite standard, I can't find it. It's not in there. The words a major contributing cause or contributed independently are not in that deposition. Why do I get hung up about that? I am not afraid of saying their magic words. I'm not afraid of that at all because, number one, this is a statutory remedy. This is a remedy created by our legislature in response to policy needs.
But isn't that a conclusion of law that the hearing examiner can draw based on the testimony? Isn't that a conclusion of law as opposed to having an expert have to say those magic words?
Well, I would think instead that it actually has to be part of the analysis of the physician in his actual words, because then it gives a chance to explore what do you mean when you say a major contributing cause or contributed independently, Dr. Hoverston. When you say that, and you know this guy's been smoking a pack of cigarettes or more for a long, long time, and you know he's had a car crash in 1996 that had an effect, a hyperextension type of effect, and you know that this man's had some fracture in his facet joint before 1997 that actually never healed, which can be part and parcel of the smoking concept. I don't know. We asked him that during the deposition and said, you know, what about this fracture? It never healed. What's up with that? Why isn't this thing healing over the course of 5 years? And I suggested maybe the smoking thing is playing a role here. What's going on here? I think it is required, Your Honor, basically because, number one, the statute requires it. Number two, if the doctor doesn't explain how he gets to that fundamental premise, that A major or that contributed independently language, then he's not giving anybody a basis for his opinion. And the Department of Labor shouldn't be reading into the deposition, putting words in when they're not there. That's the problem with this particular case. Dr. Hoverston did his best to try to describe this, but he did say on page 13 of his deposition specifically that the fracture is the reason that the guy has the surgery in 2002. And the language he uses is, whatever it was that injured this facet, I think is what led to the early on stenosis, the instability, and the need for the surgery, which we did in 2002. That's on page 13. Well, once he said that, it doesn't matter. I think once he said that, and you can do anything you want to with the rest of his testimony, it seems to me that he's already kind of laid a position out there that says, it's the fracture. It's the fracture that did this. So I think that when the department went out of their way to glean from his testimony what they thought the result should be, I think that's incorrect. I think they should not have done that. They decided this case based upon a record that wasn't there, and to that extent, I think that this is a mistake. I would point to the fine line of cases in this jurisdiction where that's come to be front and center in these cases. The old Amy Day case with John Morrell back in 92, I think it was, 490 Northwest 2nd, 720, just like this. The doctor's deposition testimony didn't have the language in it, none of them. Secondly, the Brady Home versus Hankey case, that's 597 Northwest 2nd, 677, same thing. The doctor's deposition didn't have the language in it. I'm not afraid of calling it magic language because I think this is a statutory remedy. There's no common law relative to this. You've got to have these prerequisites. And why is that true? Here's part of the deal. This gentleman has a pre-existing condition of some sort that may not be work-related at all. Why should a workers' compensation carrier be responsible for that in the future? Why should they be picking that up? They have to pick it up when the medical proof shows it. And that's why the language is important, and that's why the language invites the parties to explore how the doctor reaches the conclusion. That's why I think when you don't have it in there and you start saying, oh, it's really in there, I think you're on a slippery slope. I think it just becomes a big mess real quickly. I'm not afraid of having a bright line in these depositions and saying you've got to have this proof and you've got to show from the physician's point of view why there's a relationship between the injury and the surgery or treatment.
Well, he established there's a relationship, but he doesn't use those magic words. Isn't that, I mean...
I think what he did, Your Honor, on one hand is, as I said, I think that he establishes that the need for the surgery is from the fracture. I think that's in the deposition testimony. Later on, he says, well, the fracture is something I found out when I was in the surgical suite. I didn't know about it before. I know about it now. And now I know it's injury-based. That's all I can be sure of. When that fracture occurred, I don't know. I do know the guy had this event at work where he slipped. He came to me after that, and it was a year, about 9 months later that he ended up doing the surgery, I think it was. Or maybe it was more than like 11. But anyway, the point is that there's some lag time in there. You know, had he used the language, I think, Your Honor, had he said, well, it's a major contributing cause, then at least you could explore with him, okay, what about the smoking? What about the car crash? You could at least go through that with more precision and say, okay, are these factors too? Are they part of the contributing causes? Because we know the fracture is part of the contributing cause because he said so. He said that's the reason the guy came to surgery.
So he didn't present himself to the doctor until the slip and fall.
Correct.
That's what really led to all of this.
Correct.
So it's not reasonable to assume. I mean, Overson clearly said the fracture was the cause. And if the first time he shows up at the doctor is right after he falls, isn't it reasonable to assume, to put these together and say this is the cause? The fall is the cause?
I think one could make that leap of faith. I think it's dangerous. I think if you do that and you don't have the doctor fully explain how the relationship really works in light of the other contributing factors that are clearly present, then I think that's the failing of that leap of faith. I think that's why, if you're going to make a carrier, an employer responsible for lifetime of benefits to a surgical back, you had better have all this information in place, clearly stated and understood. That would be my response. If I may step ahead here for a second, maybe I don't have time to do that.
About a second.
Okay, here it is. There's no evidence in the record of payment by Wise, by any health insurer. There's no record of any payment of unpaid balances or an attorney's fee contract agreement with the health insurers or an attorney's fee agreement by the medical providers with Wise's counsel. So I don't know how he can make a claim that there's some special arrangement regarding the attorneys, the payment of medical expenses to Wise's counsel. The evidence is not in the file that supports that, and we contend that the department and the circuit court missed that point. Should not be done that way.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Wiedenauer, you have 10 minutes, sir.
I would like to start by addressing some of the issues that Mr. Schultz raised regarding the causation issue. I think Mr. Schultz confuses the timeline of the facet fracture with the timeline of December 5, 2001 injury. If you look at the medical records, and if you also look at the testimony Dr. Hoverston gave, Dr. Hoverston does not attribute any symptoms whatsoever to that facet fracture. He was surprised to find it in the surgical suite. It's only after that December 5, 2001 slip in the mud that did Mr. Wise manifest any symptoms. Now, I don't know why, I do know why employer, I'm sure, want to distance themselves from Dr. Hoverston at this point, because Dr. Hoverston changed his mind regarding causation to the detriment of the employer and the insurer in this matter. I think that's inconsistent. They indicate that he didn't, it somehow his opinions lack foundation. This is a physician, orthopedic physician, that's been treating Mr. Wise since 1988. And I go to the Byron case where Dr. Suga was Byron's treating physician, opined that the condition was degenerative. The court basically ignored Dr. Cho's testimony to the contrary. Secondly, or again, I would like to stress that with respect to the employer and insurer's argument on causation, after hearing Dr. Hoverston's testimony, unequivocal testimony in this matter, they had the option to go out and solicit a second opinion from a physician of their choosing. They chose not to. I think that's dispositive, or it can lead one to the conclusion that it's dispositive. Getting back, I'd like to kind of back up a second and talk about the feasibility of vocational rehabilitation for Mr. Wise. The statute requires that Mr. Wise, as the claimant, present evidence, expert testimony, regarding whether or not vocational rehabilitation is, in fact, feasible. If you turn to conclusion 25, 26, and 27 of the department's findings of fact and conclusions of law, it's basically speculation that vocational rehabilitation was feasible despite Mr. Wise's reluctance. In those finding or conclusions of law, there is no mention of Mr. Wise's expert testimony, the testimony that Mr. Wise put forth from his expert. His reluctance, and maybe this goes to Mr. Wise's station of life, but his reluctance reflects his situation, that he's a 50-year-old concrete worker. Never hasn't.
But not even to try, according to Mr. Schultz. He says, not interested.
I disagree with that. I mean, do you force specific, do you force this gentleman to go to school to be an ultrasound technician? Or do you let him go to the Volunteers of America and upgrade his skills, learn how to use a cash register, learn how to stock shelves, learn how to do kind of those inside light-duty jobs in order to get out and back into the job market? I think that's the issue. I don't think it's reasonable to assume that, well, you haven't tried to be an ultrasound technician. Well, we got to look at the likelihood. Is it reasonable? I don't think so.
But if he's just stocking shelves, what's that pay in Sioux Falls? $6 an hour? $6.50?
Yes. And that fits squarely with Mr. Wise's expert testimony. That was Mr. Audet's opinion, and that's what the department found, that he couldn't earn anything more than sporadic or couldn't engage in anything more than sporadic employment resulting in insubstantial income.
At what point in time did the rehabilitation expert for the insurer offer those five or six jobs which they claim were light duty, which were comparable to what Mr. Brooks was making?
That was after Mr. Brooks had obtained as a position at Austed's and in the context of litigation in this matter. They retained Mr.
It came in through a deposition of the rehabilitation expert?
Correct.
Was it ever advanced to him prior to that?
Yes.
It was?
Yes. I believe Mr. Carroll was in contact with Mr. Wise during...
Prior to him going to work for Austed's?
Yes. No, after.
After he started working
for Austed's. The employer and insurer didn't get their vocational expert on board until, they just basically denied benefits and let him go.
And those five or six positions were, do you concede they were light duty supervisory positions in concrete work?
I don't concede that.
You don't what?
I don't concede that, Justice. This is concrete work. Mr. Audet opined that they're at least medium, if not heavier, jobs. And Mr. Schultz alluded to this fact, too. There's disagreement. I mean, you got these kind of really neat, clean classifications in the vocational standards for federal guidelines. And then you've got what actually happens out on the job site when the cement truck pulls up and... You got to get the form set, and you got to get the cement poured before the sun goes down. I would submit that there are no light duty jobs, supervisory jobs in concrete construction.
Was there testimony in the record supporting that?
I believe Mr. Audet did testify to that. Getting back to the feasibility argument, there is no conclusion of law based upon. Mr. Wise's expert opinion. Given the mandate by the legislature, I believe we're entitled to our conclusion of law, findings of fact and conclusions of law with respect to that mandate. What specifically does the department find with respect to our expert opinion? I don't know. Mr. Schultz doesn't know. The department kind of glosses over that and then goes on to Mr. Carroll's testimony. But I think, given the mandate, we're entitled
Did you propose a finding as to that?
I believe I did, yes. I believe I did. I don't have it right in front of me, but yeah. There were alternate findings that I put forth, and those were rejected. Ultimately, Your Honors, we ask that the relief be granted as requested in our briefs. I would request that you uphold, affirm the findings with respect to causation and reverse with respect to the permanent total disability benefits pursuant to the ADLOC doctrine. On behalf of Mr. Wise, I thank you.
Just a second. Okay. He's still working for Ostedt's?
Yes.
Now, and that's been continuous from the time he started?
It's my understanding, Judge, that their busy season is in the spring and in right before Christmas, when people are buying Christmas gifts. After that, it tapers off. He can work up to 30. He will work up to 30 hours a week, and then maybe it's 15, maybe it's 20, 25. It just depends on how busy the facility is.
It's your position that produces an insubstantial income?
Yes.
And your position that that's sporadic?
Yes.
It's a full-time job, but on a part, it's a continuous job, but it's part-time, huh?
Yes. Yes.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Wiedenauer. The court will be in recess until 9 o'clock tomorrow morning.